This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's hard to overstate how irregular the news cycle is at the moment, and with new allegations about the Trump administration's Russian ties coming out seemingly on the hour, it can be difficult to make sense of what's really going on, even for journalists.
But for NPR's Scott Detrow, that's all in a day's work. Detrow is a congressional reporter and the co-host of the NPR Politics podcast, where he regularly sits down with other journalists to talk about what's going on in Washington.
Detrow was in Milwaukee this past Tuesday and visited the Lake Effect bungalow to speak with producer Joy Powers.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you're the host of NPR's Politics podcast, which was intended to be more of a weekly program.
Now we're hourly at times, it seems.
Basically, right? With the current pace of the news cycle, how are you keeping up?
By spending a lot of time staring at my phone and going through my battery over and over again. I mean, it's just really been remarkable. It feels like, you know, it feels like we've been at that pace in the final week or so of an election nonstop since the election, with very little breaks, if any. And there's just no sign that that's going to slow down anytime soon. And we've had different kinds of news. Like, at first, the Trump administration was announcing all these big shifts, all these big executive orders that really, really, you know, caused a huge, like, cannonball in the water in terms of just how Washington operates. And lately, it's been just story after story after story from all these different news outlets breaking ground on this story about Russian meddling in the election and whether or not anyone on the Trump campaign coordinated or colluded with Russia to do that. So it's been a lot.
There's so many places we could start. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to find the right road in, but I think Russia is probably the place that we do start.
Yeah.
One of the big things that Donald Trump has been saying more recently is that, you know, the news is using all of these anonymous sources, and anonymous sources essentially can't be reliable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, for just sort of transparency, as a reporter, how do anonymous sources work, really? Who are the anonymous sources? Obviously not specifically, but
yeah.
What are these situations?
Well, I think it's the same pattern that plays itself out, whether it's, you know, city council or the state legislature or the federal government. They're people who work within the administration, work within whatever you're covering, who, for one motivation or another, and it's always different, and there's always some sort of motivation, want to get information out to reporters. And I think Trump's White House has a unique situation where everybody, there are different camps within the White House who are at war with each other and leaking information on each other that create a lot of these news stories. You have, like, the Jared Kushner wing of the White House. You have the Steve Bannon wing of the White House. They often don't get along with each other and are providing this information to the reporters who cover the White House, who can then go talk to the other camp as well. So you have that dynamic. And then this thing that keeps evolving with this story specifically, it seems like there are people within the national security community, within the National Security Council, based on some of the information that's getting out there, who are leaking this information to reporters as well. That seems to be the best assumption based on what sort of information is making its way to the public.
And why do these people choose to be anonymous? Why don't they go on the record?
I mean, I don't know. I think for some of the stories that we're talking about here, you could probably go to jail for being on the record or get fired. But, I mean, people always pass along information, and I think that to complain about anonymous sources is kind of the first step that any president or any public official will take when they don't like the news that's happening. And look, President Trump is somebody who knew how to play the media throughout his career, incredibly media savvy person who would call the New York tabloids over and over again as he made his rise. And guess what? He would give them anonymous tips about himself. Sometimes he even impersonated a spokesperson in order to get a good quote or a good story into the newspaper. So this is something that the Trump administration does itself to its advantage and has done to its disadvantage. It's just a part of the news cycle all over the place.
And that's something that's become sort of complicated in this narrative. As Trump and Sean Spicer and some of his surrogates are saying, oh, these, you know, these leaks are fake. They're all fake news.
Which they're not.
you also have many of his surrogates going out and coming up with reasons to defend whatever has happened, whatever someone has done. How do you as a journalist figure out what narrative is really coming out of this administration when you have people who are in the same building saying different things?
And you have this dynamic that's happened over and over again with the Trump administration as well, where a top-level surrogate like Sean Spicer, like H.R. McMaster, like several other members of this administration will come out and deny something or say something is X. And then the next morning on Twitter, President Trump undercuts them and something that they denied he says happened, or he says why and totally changes the story on them. I mean, that happened. The best example is with his decision to fire FBI Director James Comey. The initial message from the White House was that this was done in response to a memo from Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, that this was based on his recommendation and it was all about the way that Comey handled the investigation into Hillary Clinton's private email server. The very next day, not the very next day, 2 days later, Trump talks to NBC News and says, no, that's not the reason I fired him. I knew I was going to fire him all along. And he says, he admits to NBC that he was thinking about the Russia investigation at the time he made that decision. So that totally undercuts not only Sean Spicer, but the vice president, Mike Pence, and several others who were giving this one reason. Then Trump says, no, it was the other reason. As to the idea that this is fake news in general, the media is not making up this story. They are not making up the fact that the FBI has an ongoing investigation into whether or not anyone on Trump's campaign colluded with Russia. There's no clear answer on whether or not that's the case, but there is an active investigation. There's an active Senate investigation. There's an active House investigation. And lawmakers from both parties take the idea that Russia tried to influence the election incredibly seriously. The only high-profile elected official who's out there saying this is all a distraction is the president. I mean, you have Richard Burr, a Republican. You have many other Republicans, Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, I could go on, who are saying this is something we need to take seriously, and we don't know what the facts are going to say, but we need to look into it.
Speaking as someone who's a journalist far, far away from D.C., it seems odd that the president is able to lie in this way. I'm trying to think of how to ask this question. You know, how does he get away with it? Like, that's the question. How does he get away with it?
Yeah, well, I think we in the media like to, you know, think hard thoughts about ourselves and circularly talk about ourselves and ponder journalism all the time. That's not new. But I think it's pretty straightforward. You have to report what the president's saying. It's the president of the United States and he's saying something. But the very next sentence you say, you know, that's not the case. The facts say otherwise. In actuality, I mean, there's a whole bunch of different ways to say it. I think NPR has made an editorial decision that we continue to stand by, that saying the president is a liar is not the best way to go about reporting and being objective journalists. But I don't think that means we mince words at all. I repeatedly throughout the campaign would say President Trump is saying this. That's just not true. Here's what the reality is. Here's what the facts are. The best example being the whole issue of his birther campaign, that he was the leading proponent of the false idea that President Obama was born in another country. I think that Trump has had some success kind of distorting the reality on a lot of things, this Russia being one example. You know, a much more insubstantial example would be a much smaller scale example would be the idea that he had a bigger crowd than Obama at the inauguration, which just was objectively not true and very easily proven otherwise. But I think he's kind of started to run into the limits of that a lot of times, where his tweets don't have the same impact that they did before in terms of changing the conversation or threatening Republican lawmakers or things like that. I think sometimes he puts it out there and you see his staff almost immediately cringe in the way that they have to, like, you know, follow up and justify the things that he said that day.
So Mike Dubke, Trump administration's communications director, mm-hmm. has stepped down. What is the significance of that?
I'm not quite sure. He was someone who came onto the administration after it got up and running and always had a much more behind-the-scenes role. I think the most interesting thing about that announcement is that he apparently submitted that resignation letter 2 weeks ago, and it was only public until today. I mean, this is a White House that basically every behind-the-scenes decision has made its way to the newspaper or cable news almost instantaneously. So that was notable. The big question has been, will there be a broader staff shakeup? There's clearly the White House is having a lot of problems with not just the Russia investigation eating up all the oxygen in Washington, but having a hard time passing its legislative agenda in Congress as well. So there's been a lot of talk. Will they bring in a new chief of staff? Will they bring in a new press secretary? Will there be staff changes? And the fact that President Trump just has a long habit of kind of thinking out loud to everybody he comes in contact with has certainly kept that perception, because he's apparently walking around saying, hey, what do you think? Do you think Reince is doing a good job? Do you think Sean's doing a good job? Should I make a change? So we'll see if there are bigger changes. We're talking, what is it, Tuesday? See, days just melt into each other now. We'll see what happens in the next 20 minutes or so. But I think a lot of people saw that initial news and thought maybe this could be the beginning of a bigger staff shakeup.
And that's been sort of in the works. A lot of people have felt, it seems almost from the beginning, that there was going to be some kind of shakeup in the White House. And, you know, we keep hearing about leaks. Does the talk about a shakeup seem to be the Trump administration's attempt to shore up the base, as it were?
Not sure. And I think the staff obviously matters, but every White House revolves around the president. And this one seems to be even more so. I mean, the message of the day is not the message that the communications director is plotting out and rolling out. The message of the day is what President Trump decides to tweet at 6:15 that morning. You know, so I think it's hard to be any sort of communications professional working in this administration, because it's so volatile and it can go in so many different directions. And I know that Republicans and Congress have a hard time because they're trying to work through a health care bill that's going to take months to write and to draft and to pass. And they don't know what Trump is going to wake up the next morning and say in terms of what sort of bill he'd like to see. You know, this morning he was talking about how the Senate needs to change its rules and pass health care faster. Actually, the process they're using, they only need 51 votes to pass this bill, but it's going to be really hard to get 51 votes because within the Republican caucus, there's a whole range of opinions on how aggressive or how much of a delayed implementation the new healthcare system should look like.
Well, and that's a question, of course. We're in Wisconsin. Paul Ryan, congressman from the 1st Congressional District of Wisconsin, part of our listening area. Mm-hmm. The CBO score comes out on his Obamacare replacement plan, and it was pretty damning.
Yeah, I think Paul Ryan makes the argument that so the number you're referring to is the 22 million people who would be without health insurance a decade from now. That's a little less than earlier versions of the plan, 24 million, but it's still in the same ballpark. A lot of people who have insurance now would not have insurance in a few years because of this. Ryan's argument would be that's the wrong way to look at it, because we are giving Americans the freedom to not have health care if they don't want it. But a lot of independent analysis has said this is a plan that would also jack up the cost and make unaffordable health insurance for a lot of people, especially who have pre-existing conditions. This would kind of go back to the pre-Obamacare landscape where people can be charged different rates for different conditions, and you don't have to have that parity that was forced down. Now, I think there is a lot of legitimate criticism that under the current Obamacare system, there are a lot of people who feel like they can't afford insurance as of right now. Is this the best way to address that problem? It seems like this plan doesn't solve problems for those people. And I think a lot of Republicans would say to you, yeah, and this plan isn't going to become law. We were getting something that we could pass to get to the Senate. That may be the case, but this is still going to be fodder for a lot of campaign ads against the House Republicans who voted for this plan that, as you say, has analysis that is pretty politically grim for them.
And that's my next question, really. You know, we're hearing that this plan is likely not going to pass, but really Ryan was the mastermind behind it. Has this affected his standing in D.C.?
I don't think so. I mean, I think this was just a more extreme version of what you see all the time, that you cobble together a plan to get through one chamber, it goes to another chamber, and they make big changes and they send it back. That's how legislating works. It was pretty tough for him politically when they weren't able to pass the plan at all in the House a couple months ago. That was pretty bad. And if they had failed a second time, I think people would have had really serious questions about what does this mean for Paul Ryan going forward. But in that moment, he was able to cobble together a very thin majority, but enough votes to get this measure passed and move it to the next step. And I think just being able to pass it through the House, even though that doesn't become a law, I think it proved to a lot of people in the Republican base, look, we are making progress on this. We are taking this seriously.
Just quick, as we sort of reach the end here, Trump just came back from his first trip overseas, and it was somewhat unusual. You know, he was very friendly with the Saudi Arabians, seemingly cold toward our allies in Europe. What were the highlights and what were the lowlights of this trip?
I guess it depends on your perspective, right? The White House thought that this was a very successful trip. They were happy with it. Not much unplanned news was made, which for them was kind of a nice break from the way that things operate on a daily basis. But yeah, Trump goes to NATO and he gives a speech and decidedly does not endorse the heart of the NATO alliance, that attack on one country is an attack on every country. And that clearly left key American allies like Germany and France feeling uncomfortable, feeling unsure of what this means for the relationship. And I think it's pretty remarkable that you have Angela Merkel campaigning a couple days later saying Europe needs to take itself in its own hands and not rely on the United States in the way that we have for the last 50 or 60 years. Still, Trump, I think, was very happy to do the head of state thing in other countries. They felt like it went well. They really appreciated the rollout in Saudi Arabia and Israel specifically. They felt like he was being given the respect that they feel kind of aggrieved that they don't seem to get on a regular basis here in the United States. Of course, that's the difference between the government in the United States and in Saudi Arabia. There's a lot more open criticism of any president, no matter who's in the White House here in the U.S.
Yeah, in Saudi Arabia, protesting is essentially punishable by death, right?
Yeah, a little bit of an apples and oranges situation.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks. It was great to be here.
Scott Detrow is a congressional reporter for NPR, and he's one of the hosts of the NPR Politics podcast. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers while he was here in Milwaukee this past Tuesday.